Koresh from his long drive.
You've read his bio, but just to summarize, he's written a number of books and has brought a couple with him this evening that he'd like to tell us about and also be willing to find and personalize for us. But really an interesting perspective this evening on the Battle of South Mountain. I know when we went out, what was it, 5 years ago, and did the Antietam run? Who attended that? Vicki, is that right? Wasn't that 4 or 5 years ago? We didn't really get to spend much time up on South Mountain, but a fascinating battle, and really the first time Lee and his men were halted in their assault of the north. John Hoptak serves as an interpretive park ranger at Antietam at the battlefield, and also teaches courses in American history and Civil War history as an adjunct instructor at the American Military Institute. He's listed his books in his bio. John is very active in preservation and promotion of local history. And again, we're very pleased that he made the trip over to join us this evening to talk about Antietam's bloody prelude, the Battle of South Mountain. John Hoptak.
All right. Well, first let me begin by saying thank you. Thank you for turning out tonight, and thank you to Jenny and for John and for Dr. John for the invitation to come out here. My very first time in Indiana.
First.
It only took me 33 years to get here. My dad, who came along, who's hiding back there, took him 65 years to get here for the first time. We are excited to be here. Of course, along the way, I'm telling them about famous Indianans. You know, David Letterman, Hoosiers. David Letterman, of course, by Ambrose Burnside, right? How far to Liberty? Liberty, Indiana. Is it a long, far drive from here?
40 miles.
Hour and a half? Maybe the 9-hour drive home tomorrow will be 11 hours. Yeah. We'll see. Very good. But very pleased to be here. I'll be talking tonight about a little-known battle, but a very important battle. First, by show of hands, I saw some hands go up just moments ago. Who here has been to the Antietam National Battlefield? Yeah, that's what I thought. Very good. Excellent. I remember most of you when you came to visit. Who here has been to the South Mountain Battle? Okay. All right, more than I thought. Very good. For those of you who have been to the South Mountain Battlefield, I don't need to exaggerate how difficult it is to navigate that battlefield. It's tough. It's mostly privately owned still. A small state park operates portions of the battlefield, but the roads are narrow, the roads are windy, they're twisty, and there's an awful lot of no trespassing signs up on most about every house. So you got to be careful. The first time I went to South Mountain Battlefield was back in 2005 when I was hired at Antietam. I thought, well, I should get to know about this battle. So a colleague of mine went over, and we did what Civil War tourists do. We stopped in the roadway, we put the four ways on, we backed up, we reversed, we turned around, a couple three-point turns. Well, someone was paying attention, because on our way down to Crampton's Gap, I got pulled over by the state police. And they wanted to know if I was on the battlefield recently, because someone reported a suspicious vehicle. And as it turned out, my vehicle, an old 1994 Oldsmobile I was driving, matched the description of a vehicle that was involved in a recent home break-in. So, yeah, I was just trying to learn about the battle. But please do not let that deter you from visiting South Mountain. So let's talk about Antietam. Let's talk about South Mountain. Antietam, of course, is famous or infamous, bloodiest single-day battle in American history. We know the numbers. 13 hours of battle, 23,000 casualties. It's the battle that will also bring about the Emancipation Proclamation. So Antietam has really overshadowed the September 14th battle at South Mountain, which was fought 3 days before. But what I'm going to argue tonight, or talk about, is that this was a very important battle. As you see up here, it's the first major battle fought north of the Potomac River. And I say major battle because there were more than 5,000 casualties that Sunday, the 14th of September. That's comparable to First Manassas, or First Bull Run. Also, this battle is very central to our understanding of the Maryland campaign. Had it not been for South Mountain, of course, there not would have been Antietam 3 days later. Up top is a quote I found from a soldier who fought at South Mountain. "I am afraid the large battle of Wednesday," by which he meant Antietam, "will entirely overshadow our division's fight at Crampton's Pass, part of the South Mountain battlefield." And boy, he was most certainly right. Just by the show of hands we had just a few moments ago, South Mountain has kind of languished in the shadows. So let's go back to early September of 1862. Of course, the American Civil War is a year and a half old at this point. And Robert E. Lee, we know who he is. He doesn't need any kind of introduction. 54 years old, commanding the Army of Northern Virginia. Robert E. Lee is hoping to follow up a tremendously successful summer for his army. Now, Lee had taken command of the Army of Northern Virginia only 3 months prior to this. So he is a relatively new Army commander, just 90 days. But during his first 90 days in Army command, one victory after the next. 7 days battles, Second Manassas. And by early September, Lee's men had taken this war from the gates of Richmond to the very outskirts of Washington, D.C. And now the question for Lee is, what to do next? And as I sometimes argue, Robert E. Lee is a victim of his own success. Because quite frankly, he really had no other viable option. He had cleared most of Virginia of Union troops. Two Union armies are now retreating into the safety of Washington, D.C. So his options were either to fall back toward Richmond. Of course, he's not going to hand over the initiative. Another option, perhaps, head toward Washington and attack the national capital. Certainly, there were a lot of people in D.C. who thought that Lee was heading that way. There was panic in Washington. In fact, there was a boat anchored in the Potomac ready to take Abe Lincoln and family north just in case Lee should attack. But Lee knows that his army simply could not attack the capital. Washington is a fortress. Has anyone ever toured the Civil War defenses of Washington? Pretty neat, pretty impressive. Some cannons that were just so large, they decided not to move after the war, and they're still there today if you go to Fort Foote or Fort Washington. So again, make that part of your next trip over to the Antietam battlefield. Lee knows he can't attack Washington, so his only other option then is to go north. And over the years, historians have kind of looked, I think, a little bit too much into why Lee went north. We hear a lot over the years that Lee went north hoping to gain Maryland as a Confederate state. Now, this was certainly the Confederate politicians were interested in. From day one, many down south believed that Maryland belonged with the Confederacy. It was, after all, a slave state. And if you remember, Abraham Lincoln is going to do some, well, you might say, unconstitutional things to keep Maryland in the Union, keep it secure in the Union. And Robert E. Lee will say as much to Jefferson Davis, of course, president of the Confederacy. If ever we have an opportunity to give the people of Maryland a chance to cast off the yoke of Yankee oppression, this is it. So historians will take that quote and say that Lee was going into Maryland on a diplomatic mission to kind of get Maryland with the Confederacy. But Robert E. Lee knew exactly what Jeff Davis wanted to hear. And Jeff Davis, when he heard this, well, his eyes lighted up. At last, we'll get Maryland. So when he heard that, he will say, hold on, I'm coming north to go with you into Maryland. And this was the absolute last thing Robert E. Lee wanted, right? To have a Confederate president traveling with his army. So as soon as he crossed into Maryland, he will write back to Davis and say, look, except for individual expressions of support, do not anticipate a general rising of the people here in our behalf. Lee actually began the campaign knowing that he is not going to get much in the way of support from Maryland. And the reason why was geography. When he went north into Maryland, he did so right through the center of the state. And central Maryland, western Maryland, was very strong Union territory. Now, had he come up further east, Chesapeake Bay area, it might have been a different story. But even before he embarked on the campaign, he met with one of his generals, a native of Frederick, Maryland, right in the middle of the state. And that guy said, look, these people out here are Union. So Lee, of course, is not really going into Maryland for diplomatic or statehood reasons. Historians have also looked at, well, perhaps he was going into Maryland to finally convince Great Britain to join the Confederate side. And again, this was something the Confederate government was into from the very start. But Lee, first and foremost, he's a military man. And his primary objective in going into Maryland is to win a battle. Pure and simple. I'm sure we're all very familiar with the Gettysburg campaign. Much the same reason that motivated his campaign 10 months later, go north, achieve a victory on Union soil. This is what Lee was hoping to do here in Maryland in September of 1862. 3 years after the war ended, Robert E. Lee had an interview, and he was asked a question, why did you go into Maryland in September of 62? And without missing a beat, Lee said, I went into Maryland to give battle. So his primary objective in this campaign, go north, sweep across the Potomac River, and by doing so, force the Union Army to follow. Force the Union Army to abandon their fortifications in Washington, draw them out onto good ground, and on that ground, destroy them. So that is the goal. And up to this point, everything had been going Lee's way. His army began to look invincible on a battlefield. We know the success. But as soon as this campaign got started, it is nothing but headache after headache. This campaign, this two-week campaign in Maryland, which will end at Antietam, nothing but problems for Lee. And his first problem was the most recognizable one. His men had been on the march for 10 straight weeks. They are tired, they are worn out, they are hungry. Now on September 2nd, 2 days before the campaign began, Lee's army had a headcount. How many men are available? And on September 2nd, there were 65,000 men in Lee's army. Fast forward 2 weeks to Antietam, he was lucky if he had 45,000 left. So what happened to all of these men? They're simply not keeping up. Straggling was a tremendous problem. And in almost every letter, he wrote a letter almost every day during the course of this campaign to Jeff Davis. In almost every single one of those letters, he will complain about the number of stragglers from his army. Men who simply cannot keep up. And for some of these men, he said, now these are Lee's words, for some of these men, it results from necessity. These men are tired and they have no shoes. But for the greater number, it results entirely from design. These men are the cowards of this army who desert their comrades in the hour of need. So we can sense the frustration building as Lee's army embarked upon this very important campaign, the first time he crossed into Union soil, and his army is simply melting apart. Now, it was a hallmark of the Lost Cause ideology. Of course, we know after the war, Virginians went to bat in writing the history of this war. There's an old phrase, of course, the victors write the history. I will respond with the Civil War, the Virginians write the history. But so much of the Lost Cause is to continually decrease the number of men that Lee had on any battlefield of the war. And of course, some will say that he went into Maryland with only 40,000 men, which was not true. There was a Union officer in 1895 who wrote that, I hear now that Lee was at Maryland with only 30,000 men. Pretty soon we'll hear that he fought the entire battle by himself and his adjutant. But when he began the campaign, he had over 65,000 troops. That number is quickly going to fall apart. And one of the first things he did when he got back into Virginia after the campaign, he will write one of his first reports that his army was reduced by one-third just by straggling alone, even before they fired a shot. So that's a problem. Another problem Lee is going to have in this campaign, there it is, that name up there, George McClellan. Now what do you think of when you hear that name, George McClellan? What are some adjectives that have been used over the years to describe this guy? Slow, right? Cautious, very timid.
Great organizer.
Great organizer, yes, absolutely right.
Not much of a fighter.
Not much of a fighter, okay, we heard that a lot. Villainous sometimes, right? I actually heard somebody at Antietam say that he deliberately withheld troops. He didn't want to win that battle because it will give Lincoln a victory in the polls. Now, George McClellan is a soldier. He's a professional. He's a West Pointer. He's class of 1846, graduates second, just like Robert E. Lee. The two men have very much the same in common. George McClellan has been described over the years as ambitious, as vain, as arrogant, right? We hear all these terms. And that all might have been true. I didn't know him personally. But
did he have ambitions to run for president?
He did, yeah. Well, he certainly had a lot of precedents before him.
64.
Yeah, 64, sure. But his precedent was George Washington. It was William Henry Harrison. It was Andrew Jackson. It was Zachary Taylor. It was all these generals who win great laurels on the battlefield. And yes, he did not like Lincoln. Lincoln did not really care much for George McClellan. But for all his character flaws, you said it, when it came to organizing armies, even more importantly, when it came to inspiring men to fight, Abraham Lincoln simply had no one better than this. And I like to say that early September of 1862, these might have been the darkest days the Union would experience throughout the entire war. You know, in early June, the newspapers were saying that the war will be over by the 4th of July, and all our men will be home by Christmas. Well, of course, by July, things had changed. And by September, they have gotten even worse. Two defeated, demoralized Union armies are limping back into the capital. morale was low. Lincoln, General-in-Chief Halleck, they left the White House on the morning of September 2nd, and they walked all the way to George McClellan's home. George McClellan still had his rank, but he really did not have a command anymore. Much of his army had been given to John Pope. Well, here comes Lincoln knocking on the door. "George, I need you. You're the only man I have who could whip these troops back into shape." This went against the advice of his entire cabinet. Secretary of War Edmund Stanton wanted McClellan court-martialed. Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon Chase, wanted McClellan shot. But, despite that opposition, Abraham Lincoln knows McClellan's strength. He reappoints McClellan Army Commander, and George McClellan will immediately go to war. Now, George McClellan was there in late July of 1861 to pick up the pieces after 1st Manassas, right? And he appeared again in early September of 62, having to clean up this mess. He'll write to his wife, "This is a terrible task. This is a thankless task, but he does accept, and he'll immediately go to war." And you heard those terms, timid, cautious, slow. None of that applies to this campaign. This two-week campaign, in my estimation, will be George McClellan's shining moment. Because September 2nd, reappointed Army Command, by September 6th, he's already marching out of Washington, heading out in pursuit of Lee's army, moving much quicker than Lee or anybody could have ever imagined. On September 9th, just a few days after Lee crossed the Potomac, he wrote to Jeff Davis, and he said that from what my sources can gather, the Union Army is still gathering about their defenses in Washington. But by September 9th, George McClellan was almost right on the heels of Lee. So McClellan's moving quick. Lee's unaware, and the reason why Lee is unaware, that other problem that I have listed there, Jeb Stuart. We know Jeb Stuart. His job was Chief of Cavalry. His job was to report on the location, the strengths, the movements of the Union Army. And quite frankly, during this campaign, he's not turning in his finest performance. Kind of repeats that again 9 months later, right? And I say that again because of that letter that he wrote, that Lee wrote to Jeff Davis. I say that also because if you read Jeb Stuart's report carefully, he kind of knows he dropped the ball a little bit. When he said things like, "George McClellan moved with deliberate deception. George McClellan ordered his army not to light campfires that night so he could hide." So again, Jeb Stuart leaving Lee a little bit in the dark. But the biggest problem Lee is going to have in the course of this entire campaign, not the condition of his army, not George McClellan, not Jeb Stuart, the biggest problem he has is Harper's Ferry. Now, this map, I'll kind of interact with it a little bit. But the campaign began down here. It began on September 4th when Lee's army crosses the Potomac River and he marches straight north toward Frederick, Maryland, of course, about 40 miles northwest of Washington, D.C. So Lee's first stopping point was Frederick, but he doesn't want to continue north from Frederick. And the reason why? The further that he goes north toward Pennsylvania, the longer his supply lines become stretching back south. The further that he moves north from Frederick, the more vulnerable his supply lines come to Union troops moving out of Washington. So what Lee wants to do now, move west out of Frederick and cross up over South Mountain and then turn north, using much the same highway he would 9 months later during the course of the Gettysburg campaign. And by doing this, by moving west out of Frederick and heading north, he is then hoping to establish a safer line of supply running south through the Shenandoah Valley, and of course, the gateway to the Shenandoah Valley, Harper's Ferry. Who's been to Harper's Ferry? Beautiful town, right? Jefferson said, "It itself is worth a trip across the Atlantic." So why is Harper's Ferry a problem? Well, at Harper's Ferry and at nearby Martinsburg, there are nearly 13,000 Union soldiers. Garrison troops, guard troops, troops that had never been in battle. But they're there, and that's a problem. Lee knows these men are there even before he began the campaign, but he expected those troops to abandon Harper's Ferry as soon as he placed his army between them and Washington. Well, guess what? Those troops do not budge. Talk about a thorn in his side, right? No longer possible for Lee to simply cross over South Mountain, go north with 13,000 enemy troops right behind him. So what do you do if you're Lee? Things are going poorly. You have this problem down at Harper's Ferry. What do? Do you give up your campaign? Well, Lee, of course, is not going to do that. Lee is going to decide to undertake the Frederick Bold operation. He will march his army out of Frederick, and once he gets across, he is going to divide it. Some historians will say into four parts, others will say five, some will say six, but he divides his army into two large columns. One of them, under James Longstreet, will cross the mountain and continue north toward Hagerstown, just south of the Mason-Dixon line. So half of Lee's army will be going north, continuing the campaign. The other half under Stonewall Jackson, you know where they're going, right? The exact opposite direction, heading south toward Harper's Ferry. Head down toward those 13,000 Union troops, and after clearing them out of Harper's Ferry, turn back around, move north, reunite with Longstreet, and the problem is solved. Now, Lee is now ordering the division of his army of 45,000 tired troops over 20 miles of unfriendly territory. This is taking a risk, wouldn't you say? Dividing his army like this, and the reason why he's doing it, he had no idea how close George McClellan was. Had he known exactly where the Union army was in their advance out of Washington, there's no way he would have ordered the large separation of his army. But he didn't know. And that's on September 9th, he had his headquarters staff prepare the orders. Lee, during the course of this campaign, is not writing anything because 2 days before it began, he's thrown off his horse. He had a broken bone in his right hand, a sprained wrist. He undertook this entire campaign, his hands wrapped in bandages in the back of an ambulance. Can you imagine trying to operate this? So he had his headquarters write the orders, and they are titled Special Orders Number 191. And with the Indiana connection, we know all about it. Special Orders Number 191 will be distributed to every single one of Lee's officers mentioned in that plan. James Longstreet, Stonewall Jackson, Daniel Harvey Hill, John Walker, Lafayette McClaws, Jeb Stuart. Each one is getting a copy from Lee's headquarters. But Lee, as I get some eyebrows when I say this, Lee is no George McClellan when it came to organizing an army. During the course of this campaign, Lee's army was not well structured. There's no clear organization. He went north with two rather nebulous columns, Longstreet's wing, Jackson's wing, and during the course of the campaign, various divisions will be assigned to each of them. And this is the problem, because when Stonewall Jackson got his copy of Special Orders 191, he noticed that his brother-in-law, Daniel Harvey Hill's division, he thought was being detached from his command, which is why he prepared a copy of 191 for D.H. Hill, not knowing that Lee's headquarters had done the same thing. So when Daniel Harvey Hill is presented with orders from headquarters, he says, I have this already, and here it is to prove it. And for some reason, that copy from Lee's headquarters got lost, left behind in the grass south of Frederick. Now, there have been more than 60,000 books written on the American Civil War. Some of you have all of them, right? Or most of them.
Not quite.
There have been more than 60,000 books written on the American Civil War, but we still don't know how this happened. How it got lost, who lost it, Special Orders 191 remains a mystery of this war. All we know is that the order is prepared on September 9th. On September 10th, the Confederate Army begins to leave Frederick. Now, Lee had established a timetable, 3 days. He wanted his entire operation to be concluded within 72 hours, which might have been expecting a bit too much. In fact, it was 3 days even before the final elements of Lee's column evacuated Frederick. 4.5 hours later, 4.5 hours after the final column of Lee's army left Frederick, guess who's arriving in Frederick from the other direction? There's the Union army, right on their heels. I mentioned things going poorly, right? Now, the Union army will continue to arrive the following day on September 13th, and there it was, Corporal Barton Mitchell of the 27th Indiana Infantry. Who could tell me where Barton Mitchell was from? Anyone know? I tried finding out on my way here. But he is a Hoosier, and he fights with the 27th. I think no one in that regiment was lower than 5'11". Was that the 27th? But he's 45 years old. He's rather old to be a soldier. He tries to take a nap. Okay? He had marched all the way a couple miles that day, so he went to take a nap in the meadow. That same meadow, of course, just a few days earlier, was D.H. Hill's headquarters. And there it was in the grass, a copy of Lee's orders, Special Orders Number 191. he's important. So he tells his sergeant, John Bloss. John Bloss tells his captain, Peter Kopp. Peter Kopp tells the colonel, and all the way back up the chain of command until finally it arrives in the hands of George McClellan. So now the Union Army commander is handed Lee's orders. What a remarkable stroke of good luck, right? Who here wouldn't be excited by this? Now, of course, George McClellan had just arrived in Frederick to a perfect hero's ovation. Here's a sketch from McClellan arriving in Frederick. As he wrote to his wife, he was nearly pulled to pieces by the women of town, I think trying to make her jealous. But they would come up and they would shower him with flowers. They would run up to the horse and give a hug to the horse, pull on his pant leg, he said. So he arrived in Frederick to this hero's ovation, and then he established headquarters on the outskirts of town. And while he was in his tent entertaining the local businessmen and the local politicians, here comes a exhausted, panted courier saluting, "General, I think you need to see this." Hands 191 to McClellan. McClellan gives it a quick look. He stands up and he says, "Now I know what to do." Now I know what to do. And the reason why he said that, it's not that he was kind of operating blindly. The reason why he said that is all during the course of his campaign, he had been getting reports from scouts, from his cavalry, from Governor Curtin of Pennsylvania, from everywhere, that Lee is heading north toward Hagerstown. No, Lee's army is heading south toward Harper's Ferry. No, Lee's army is moving this way, that way. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense until he finally gets 191. And now he knows that Lee has just divided his army almost in every direction. So now it all makes sense. So George McClellan is given 191. He brags about it. Like I said, this is not something that happens every day. He turns to John Gibbon, his good friend, the commander of the Iron Brigade. "If I cannot whip Bobby Lee with this piece of paper, I will be willing to go home." He even sent a wire to the White House, "Mr. Lincoln, I will soon send you trophies." So he begins to brag and boast, and he was good at that. I think we can all agree. But what does 191 really tell George McClellan? First of all, remember that three-day window I talked about, the 72 hours? Well, that three-day window expired the day before. So if Lee was still following 191, this is outdated. The first thing George McClellan had to do was send his cavalry force under Alfred Pleasanton out of Frederick, heading towards South Mountain to find out whether or not Lee's army was still divided, whether this information was still current. And for everything 191 tells McClellan, there was something very important missing. One other thing that wasn't mentioned about McClellan when I asked, outnumbered. We all know that George McClellan always believed himself to be outnumbered. During the course of this campaign, he will come to believe that Lee had up over 100, maybe 120,000 men, more than twice the size that Lee actually had. And believe it or not, he was taking lower-end estimates from what his cavalry chief, Alfred Pleasanton, was telling him. Lee had over 200,000 men. That's what Pleasanton said. Governor Curtin of Pennsylvania, "Lee is on our doorstep with an army of 300,000 invaders. Don't let him get here." So George McClellan is getting so much conflicting intelligence. He's already predisposed to paranoia. So why is that important to know? Why is this important? Because he's looking at 191, and all it tells him that Longstreet is heading up toward Hagerstown, right? And it tells him that Jackson's heading toward Harper's Ferry. There's no mention of numbers. It doesn't mention how many men Longstreet had with him. It doesn't mention how many men Jackson had with him. All it told him is that Lee had just willingly divided his army over 20 miles. What does that tell George McClellan? If Lee is willing to take that risk, boy, those number figures must be true. Lee must have a very large army, or else he wouldn't do this. So 191, the value of it is being debated today. Did it help? Did it hurt? Depends on who you ask. Many people will say that it helped. Others will say no, it actually hindered George McClellan's movements. But as he continued to wait for his cavalry, oh, and another thing to keep in mind too, I think something that kind of gets overlooked. I'm a big fan of Stephen Sears, and I think most of us are. He's a tremendous writer. His book on Chancellorsville and Gettysburg is superb. His Landscape Turned Red on Antietam is very well written. I'll kind of take a different approach to George McClellan, because Stephen Sears is no fan of George McClellan, to say the least, right? I was given a tour back in March for the Civil War Trust, and I began with this whole, look, George McClellan is not a bad guy kind of thing. And at the end of my first half hour, a gentleman came up to me and said, I just want to let you know, but the gentleman in the green coat over there, Stephen Sears, went up there. So my whole tour had to be on the spot, reevaluated. But I think it needs to be kept in mind that from 2012, from 150 years later, we most certainly know how this war ended. We know that in the spring of 1865, the Union triumphs. But in early September of 62, George McClellan does not know this. And as I mentioned before, the darkest days of the Union. He'll assume this army command, and he'll go into Maryland with a brand new army, only a half of it he was familiar with. His 2nd Corps, his 5th Corps, and his 6th Corps. But he's also inheriting all of John Pope's army. That will become the 1st and the 12th Corps. He's also inheriting Burnside's 9th Corps. So he is on the spot, assuming command of all these new troops, and he'll hit the road, he'll move quickly after Lee, and he quite frankly could not lose the upcoming battle. What happens if the Union Army does get destroyed on Union soil? What happens? Well, as he wrote to Governor Curtin, it doesn't matter if Lee captures Harrisburg. It doesn't matter if Lee captures Washington. What matters is this army. Because if this army is destroyed, the nation is lost. So he knew right up front what Lee was all about. Lee was trying to learn to battle, to defeat him. So George McClellan has to be careful. He can't lose. And now reading 191, further convinced that he was up against tremendous odds. His cavalry chief, though, will come galloping back into camp that Saturday, the 13th of September, and say, we can still hear cannon fire coming from the direction of Harper's Ferry, which told them it was still holding out, that Lee's army was still divided. So McClellan will develop a plan. My general idea is to cut the enemy in two and beat him in detail. Let's go back to one of these maps here. Here is Frederick. Here is the South Mountain Range. Here is Harper's Ferry. What George McClellan wants to do is march his army out of Frederick, get up over South Mountain, and that would place his army directly between Longstreet and Jackson, squarely in the middle, where he could defeat them piece by piece. So on the night of September 13th, he begins to finalize his plans, pardon me. Most of the Union Army was on the National Road, the National Turnpike. Saw a lot of signs for that on the way out here, all the way. The National Pike goes from Frederick across South Mountain at what was called Turner's Gap. And because of 191, George McClellan believes that the bulk of Lee's army is clustered in between the small town of Boonesboro and Hagerstown. And by I mean the main body, he was thinking in excess of 60,000 men. Okay? Well, in fact, maybe only about 25,000. So the main force of the Union Army will move on that national road heading toward Turner's Gap, where they will engage Lee's main body, while the key to the entire operation will be a few miles south, and the key will be William Franklin and the men of the 6th Army Corps. Because William Franklin, his men began the day over here near Buckingstown. His orders were to cross the Catoctin Mountains, make their way towards South Mountain, and defeat a Confederate force that was defending Crampton's Gap. And once across Crampton's Gap, Franklin was to then turn south and defeat Lafayette McLaws on Maryland Heights. When that was done, that would free up 13,000 prisoners. Those men with Franklin would then move north and help Burnside, who was overseeing this attack. So for a timid, cautious army commander, his instructions for Bill Franklin was to march 14 miles, cross two mountains, fight two battles, and help out with another one, all within one day, right? That might have been expecting too much as well. Might have been, in the case of George McClellan, believe it or not, a little bit too aggressive. Either way, his orders go out, and on the morning of Sunday, September 14th, the Union Army begins moving out of Frederick, heading towards South Mountain. The Battle of South Mountain actually consists of a number of fights. Here's a few of the fellows who's going to play a prominent role. I mentioned a few of them already. Good old Burnside. I'm one of the few people at Antietam who is a champion of Ambrose Burnside. Thinking if it wasn't for bad luck, we wouldn't have any. William Franklin, we talked about in the 6th Corps. We know Jesse Reno, and I actually told my dad coming through Wheeling, there is the home of that renegade Virginian. And I say renegade Virginian because that is how he was described by Daniel Harvey Hill. Jesse Reno, of course, commanded the 9th Corps and will lose his life at the Battle of South Mountain. Joe Hooker, we know. Bartlett, Torbert, these are two brigade commanders under Franklin. It's interesting that all the once and future commanders of the Army of the Potomac were present here, and they were present at Antietam as well. George McClellan, Joseph Hooker, George Meade, Ambrose Burnside, all present on the same battlefield. Some of the Confederate figures that we'll talk about, D.H. Hill, of course, we talked about him, Samuel Garland, Thomas Drayton, Robert Rhodes Mumford, all these fellows with beards and mustaches, as we like to say at the park. But the fight for South Mountain was actually fought across a few mountain passes. And on Sunday, the 14th of September, the 9th Corps will lead the Army of the Potomac out of Frederick, heading along that national road, and they'll drop within sight of South Mountain. South Mountain that morning was defended by just one division of Confederate infantry under Daniel Harvey Hill. Daniel Harvey Hill had five brigades, a total of about 7,000 to 8,000 men. And he and his men were camped out in Boonesboro the night of September 13th. That night is the same night that Robert E. Lee found out exactly where the Union Army was. Jeb Stuart, we know him. Jeb Stuart found out that the Union Army was pushing out of Frederick, and they were getting very dangerously close to South Mountain. And Jeb Stuart realized that Lee's army was in trouble. It was still divided. So Jeb Stuart goes all the way to Hagerstown, to Lee's headquarters, and he goes into camp at 11:30 p.m., and he says, "General Lee, I don't want to alarm you, but the Union Army is just on the other side of South Mountain." And this was a turning point moment, a pivotal moment in the campaign. For the first 9 days, Robert E. Lee was calling the shots. This was his campaign, and people reacted to what he did, but now he was forced on the defense. He hit the brakes, and he'll send word back to Daniel Harvey Hill in Boonesboro, right at the base of the mountain, get up to the mountaintop and defend Turner's Pass at all costs. So Harvey Hill will get there about daybreak on the 14th, look out to the east, and see the Union Army approaching. "I've never felt a greater feeling of loneliness," that's what he said, understatement. And waiting for him also is a note from Jeb Stuart. A note, a handwritten note that said, "The Union Army approaches along this national road with only two brigades. The main force, I believe, will move much further south." So he'll take the entire cavalry and move south out of the picture. Two brigades. Well, there were two brigades in the lead, but behind them was the entire 9th Corps, then the 1st Corps, then the 2nd Corps, then the 12th Corps, then the 5th Corps. So five Union Corps using that same road. Daniel Harvey Hill has a tough job. And to defend Turner's Gap, he also had to defend two other gaps. Fox's Gap to the south, Crosstown Gap to the north. These gaps flank South Mountain. So the fighting there will pick up. I'm not going to get really into the tactics here, because even when you go to the battlefield, and those have been there before, even when you're standing on the battlefield, it doesn't make sense. I mean, trying to interpret the Battle of South Mountain, it's like trying to interpret fighting on four different islands, all occurring at the same time. The 9th Corps will be sent to the south, and they'll fight their way up over Fox's Gap. 13 hours about. Begins at 9 a.m., it will conclude at 10 p.m. The 9th Corps, after a tough fight, has gained Fox's Gap. At the same time, Joe Hooker in the 1st Corps will gain possession of Crosstown Gap. Turner's Gap does not budge. Turner's Gap does hold to the end. But with the Union Army in possession of the other two, they're actually behind the Confederates defending Turner's Gap. So that night, after a long day, thousands of casualties, Daniel Harvey Hill and James Longstreet will get together, and here comes John Bell Hood, and the three of them will say, "This doesn't look good." They'll ride down the side of the mountain, and they'll find Robert E. Lee at Boonesboro. Again, Robert E. Lee is not directing this fight. He can't. His hands are wrapped in bandages. He only heard it going on in the mountain. So here come these three weary generals. They gallop up at headquarters, and Robert E. Lee wants to know, "Well, what's the story? Our men fought bravely today, General. They put up a tough fight, but the Union Army has gained Fox's Gap. The Union Army has gained Crosstown Gap. And if we stay here, it will require but little time, and we will then be at the mercy of George McClellan." That's what Longstreet said. So this must have hit Lee like a ton of bricks, because it was only 10 days since he first began the campaign. 10 days earlier, he was at his zenith, following up this summer's worth of victories, going north, Union armies in retreat into Washington. He crosses the Potomac, goes into Maryland looking to achieve victory, and then within 10 days, he's been defeated. For the first time since he assumed Army command, Robert E. Lee knows what it's like to lose. And when he orders a retreat that night from South Mountain, he's not just retreating from that battlefield. He will decide to bring an end to the entire campaign. This entire campaign had run its course. So as he retreated from South Mountain, he wrote a few messages down to McLaws and to Stonewall Jackson down at Harper's Ferry. He had been urging them to hurry up with their operation down there. But that Sunday night, he'll write that famous dispatch. The day has gone against us, and this army will retreat by way of Sharpsburg to the Potomac River, Shepherdstown on the other side. You are desired to meet us there. So he's abandoning South Mountain. He's essentially telling Jackson and McLaws to give up at Harper's Ferry, move north, and reunite with them near Shepherdstown. So that must have been a long night. As he ordered his men to retreat from the mountaintops, they'll begin the evacuation at 10 p.m. The final men do not leave town until, or do not leave the mountaintop until 4 a.m. And Lee will then begin a retreat back west, heading toward the Potomac River. But at daybreak, let me get back to one here. Forgive me here, right? As Jenny knows, I do teach as well, but I'm still getting used to all this technology. Lee and his men here have been defeated by Reno, by Hooker. He'll order a retreat through Keatingsville, through Sharpsburg, to Shepherdstown. And as he wrote down here to McLaws and Jackson, you are desired to meet us there. But why does he halt his retreat? Early Monday morning, September 15th, Lee halts his retreat right here at Keatingsville. The reason why, because he just found out what happened down here at Crampton's Gap. Because the fighting for South Mountain didn't just occur up here. 6 miles further south is Crampton's Gap. And as I mentioned before, this is the key to the entire operation. So let's talk about William Franklin. First in his class at West Point, 1843, brilliant engineer. He was designing the Capitol Dome on the Capitol building when the war broke out. Now he's in the war. Good friend and close associate with George McClellan. Advances all the way to commander of the 6th Corps. But George McClellan didn't really have much faith in William Franklin. He was not a man who had a lot of imagination on a battlefield. But George McClellan decides to accompany Burnside and not Franklin, even though this was the key. Franklin, again, was to march his way across these mountains, fight his way through here, go south, and destroy McClaws. By destroying McClaws, it frees up Harper's Ferry. Simple as that. Franklin had his men on the move at 5 a.m. on Sunday, September 14th. They'll scale up over the Catoctins, and then once on this side, he'll halt. And he'll halt for over 2 hours, waiting for another division to catch up. That other division was still miles away. And by 11 a.m., he decides to keep going. So 2 hours, gone. He'll continue to make his way west, and he'll draw up here in front of Crampton's Gap. When he gets there, there are not more than 1,100 Confederates in his way. Two cavalry regiments, the 2nd and the 12th, three Virginia regiments, that was it, 1,100 Confederates. But when Franklin gets there, he pauses and he writes a note to McClellan. The enemy holds Crampton's Pass in great force, and I'm afraid I won't be able to get it today. When Franklin sent that to McClellan, McClellan's heavily engaged overseeing Burnside's operations up here. McClellan doesn't want to hear it. He sends a courier right back to Franklin. Carry Burkittsville, carry Crampton's Gap at all costs. I am told by Pleasanton there are not more than 1,500 Confederates down there. And how remarkably accurate that was, right? Franklin responds, no, General, there are more than 4,000 men holding the pass in strength. So Franklin's going to delay another 4 hours. And it's not until 4 p.m. that his men actually begin the assault. Some of those fellows you saw before, Torbert, Bartlett, they'll begin the attack toward Crampton's Gap. And after a stand-up fight and a bayonet charge, the Confederate line crumbles. So that by 6:30 p.m., the Union has possession of Crampton's Gap as well. So now, Frosttown Gap, Fox's Gap, Crampton's Gap are all in Union hands. Believe it or not, it was William Franklin's success the reason why Lee halted at Keatingsville. Because with Franklin behind McLaws, McLaws is trapped. McLaws has no way to go. As long as the Harper's Ferry garrison held out, there are 13,000 Union troops behind McLaws, there are 13,000 Union troops in front of them, Lee halts at Keatingsville because if the Union Army turned south to go out through McLaws, he would be right on their flank or behind them. So if he continued all the way to the river, he would be abandoning McLaws. And McLaws had 20% of his entire army. That's why Lee stops. Now, George McClellan woke up on the 15th, and it was still very much possible to carry out his plan to destroy the enemy in two and beat him in detail at the same time, freeing up Harper's Ferry. And overnight, from the 14th and the 15th, he already wired the White House. We have gained a great success today. The Corps of Reno and Hooker have carried the heights. I have yet to know what Franklin has done, but in the morning I expect even more success. So overnight he sends the orders out. Burnside, get on the move by 8 a.m. and follow Lee's army. If you will find them in retreat, attack. Franklin, at daybreak, go back and attack McLaws. 8 a.m., Burnside was told to get on the move. 12 noon, McClellan gets a note from Fritz Porter, 5th Corps commander, saying, Burnside's men have not budged from the mountain. So McClellan has to go and get Burnside going, 5 hours behind schedule. And William Franklin will move 1 mile south toward McLaws and find a line of infantry stretched out in front of him. They outnumber me 2-1. Remember that division he waited for the day before? They arrived overnight, so now Franklin had 16,000 men. So somehow in his mind, he saw 32,000 Confederates stretched out in front of him. It will not answer to attack tonight. Oh, and by the way, the cannon fire at Harper's Ferry has ceased. And that was it. George McClellan must have been heartbroken, because Harper's Ferry did surrender. 8 o'clock that Monday morning, and finally,
before Jackson was determined to be moving this way, that he was silent. And by the way, Lee is no longer at Keatingsville. At daybreak at Keatingsville, he looks around and he sees that there's no good ground here. And if the Union Army does follow off South Mountain, he can't defend it. But he knows that 3 more miles further west, just on the other side of Antietam Creek, near this town of Sharpsburg, there he knows the ground is much, much better. So early on September 4th, 15th, he'll order what was left of Longstreet and D.H. Hill to make their way west and form up behind the Antietam Creek. And as he was making his retreat that way toward the Antietam, that is when he got the note from Jackson. Through God's blessing, Harper's Ferry and its garrison are to be surrendered that morning. Lee wrote back, as soon as it's done, come north and meet me at Sharpsburg. Set the stage for the Battle of Antietam 2 days later. I will stick around if certainly if you have any questions. I want to thank you so much, Bill, for your time tonight. I didn't want to get too tactical. I try to keep it at more of a strategic level. Thank you again for your time. If you have any questions, please.
We thank you a little gift from us. It's our Civil War Roundtable for the first 50 years.
Thank you.
And we thank you again. And if you have time for maybe a couple quick questions,
sure.
And then book sales.
Excellent. I have 2 questions. I'll make them short. On that map.
Yes.
Would you point out again, Keatingsville?
Yes. Keatingsville is here, just about 5 miles west of South Mountain.
Yeah.
And Sharpsburg is 3 miles further to the west.
Who prepared that map?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I think I got it off the Civil War Trust site.
Because Keatingsville...
If not along the Antietam.
Keatingsville is more between Boonesboro... I'm sorry.
Boonesboro and Sharpsburg.
The village at the bottom of the hill.
Boonesboro.
Yeah. Keatingsville is more between Boonesboro and Sharpsburg than indicated on that map.
It was a direct line.
The old highway goes pretty much straight
right through
from Boonesboro right through to Sharpsburg.
Mm-hmm.
The second question,
mm-hmm.
Have you ever dined at the South Mountain Inn?
Personally, no. Believe it or not, even though I have done many tours up there, I've never been inside.
I could recommend the Beef Wellington.
Okay, Beef Wellington. For those who travel South Mountain, the house that is at the very top of Turner's Gap, where all 40 go through today, is the Mountain House.
Yeah.
And it's a historic structure. D.H. Hill, we use that as Confederate Command Headquarters there. So you can picture Confederate troops just filing by all day. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I might say
I seem to recall that when I was hiking the Appalachian Trail, the Appalachian Trail was right through all.
It got, yes. So when you do the journey from Maine to Georgia, a part of that will take you right through the South Mountain Boundary.
A couple of small battlefield areas.
In fact, from Turner's Gap to Fox's Gap, that stretch of the Appalachian Trail at the time of the battle was called Wood Road. And that was the avenue. That was the highway that Lee's men got from Turner's to Fox's. Even though it's this wide, John Bell Hood would say it was nothing more than a narrow pig path that we had to use to get down there. Yes, sir.
Did Burnside ever do anything right?
Oh, yeah. Now, the reason why George McClellan is going to lean so heavily on Burnside, let's forget what we know about Fredericksburg and everything after that. Let's go back to early 62. In the midst of despair, Ambrose Burnside is looking good because Burnside has just led this very successful expedition on the coast of North Carolina. And after securing New Bern, Hatteras, all of these, Lincoln was going to call him and say, hey, how about command of the Union Army of the Potomac? And Burnside says, no. So he'll serve under McClellan here. So up to this point, you could make the argument that he's the most successful general in the East for the Union. Things start to go downhill. His problem was he accepted responsibility too much. In an army full of political generals, George McClellan would begin to backstab Burnside after this campaign, especially for the Antietam performance. But Burnside, as I mentioned before, if it weren't for bad luck, he wouldn't have any, right? Very good. Liberty, Indiana. His dad was I think came from a slave-owning family in South Carolina, and he settled here in Liberty. So. There you go. I know there's a sign off the highway. Yes, sir.
What was the reason that Burnside gave for delaying so long?
Yeah, that actually has never really been answered satisfactorily. Burnside will say that he was a wing commander, that he commanded the 1st and the 9th Corps, so the command of the 9th Corps is actually Reno's, and once Reno was killed, it went to Jacob Copps. You know, so there's a lot of command, structural things going on, South Mountain. Others will say that he gave the soldiers an opportunity to view a victorious battlefield and to help bury the dead. All we know is that it was delayed. And there's a funny story, because Burnside's 9th Corps, they fought the entire day, 13 hours. They fought the entire battle by themselves at Fox's Gap. And they were tired the next day, and they're still in bivouac, in camp. And once the 5th Corps finally got moving through, there was an entire division of regulars. You know, these men who were professional soldiers. And as they made their way right past the 9th New Hampshire, in the Army 3 weeks, a volunteer force, the regulars go through the manual of arms, and they start doing all this fancy thing. And they said, step aside, 9th Corps, this is where the difference comes in. And one of the soldiers of the 9th New Hampshire yelled back, yeah, the difference is we use our weapons for fighting. Very good. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Why was a brigade of Pennsylvania troops referred to as the Philadelphia Reserves? And also one other,
sure.
Was the New Jersey, the 4th New Jersey, the only ones that had smoothbore muskets at South Mountain?
Yes, I believe they were. The 4th New Jersey, they found so many rifled muskets that had been kept behind by Cobb's brigade that they actually switched out. So I think they were the only regiment in Torbert's brigade. Yeah, and they switched them out. The Philadelphia Brigade, 2nd Corps, they weren't engaged in the Battle of South Mountain, but they got that designation, boy, I don't know when, I'm sorry to say. George Meade and the Pennsylvania Reserves, though, they led a lot of the effort at Crosstown Gap.
Were they considered like shock troops in the Army?
What happened was, when the war broke out, Pennsylvania provided too many troops. And there was a quota for Pennsylvania, and there were all these regiments that arrived in Harrisburg, and the U.S. government says, we don't need them. Well, Governor Curtin says, well, instead of going home, you're going to become Pennsylvania troops. You're going to become the 1st through the 13th Pennsylvania Reserve. Well, it wasn't long before the government came back to Curtin and said, all right, we need them. So that's why, let's say, the 8th Pennsylvania Reserve is also known as, I don't know, 32nd Pennsylvania Infantry. So, but they were very good soldiers. They had a lot of good commanders. They had a string of good commanders as well. And they seemed to be where the fight was the biggest. George McCall, George Meade, Sam Crawford at Gettysburg. If they weren't shock troops, they became them.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Feel free to hang around.
Thank you so much. Thank you.